Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 71, section 3. We got into the section a little ways. It's on old single column, page 803. And if you have a book that's numbered paper, section, paragraph, we're going to be starting with paragraph 6, a paragraph that starts A Moral Society. If you have a book that's numbered paper, section, item, that would be obviously three more, because you can see there's three items in that third paragraph there, so that would be item 9. And once we read that paragraph, I'll remind you a little bit of a thread that was going through the preceding two paragraphs there, the fourth and fifth paragraphs. But let's just, you know, remind ourselves in general that we're focusing on the full formality of a state, a territorial state, in this paper. And we had built up to this section, as you can see from the title, was giving us the ideals of statehood. In other words, those effectively transcendent elements that you are striving toward or that you are oriented toward. In some senses, you can think about eventually reaching an ideal. In other senses, it's always out of reach, and its recognition is the predicate in your mind that motivates all of the intentions and actions of your engagement of this concept of statehood. So, remember, we're trying to, the revelators are very much trying to do that very definitively here in this section and the preceding one. Remember how they started out with the ideal at the beginning of section 2 as well. They want you to work on getting the ideal separated from the idea. And remember how we saw several instances where they were pointing out very directly, not in between the lines, but literally, in the lines, that if you don't do that, if you don't separate spiritual ideals from all your efforts to form ideas engaged to the literal material issues, you blur those together, that produces a very unstable situation at best. And it's been going on at a degree and for a length of time now that is such that it literally has produced an emergency situation that's behind the giving of the fifth epical revelation in the first place. That very unfortunate tendency to try to flip things inside out, to try to make matter do a spirit thing, to satisfy your spiritual hunger, to manifest literal unity, and it can't do any of those things. Matter is matter and spirit is spirit, and they're absolutely separate. And you're making an absolute error to blur them together. So not only, when you turn things inside out like that, are you going to make a total mess of your outer life and everyone else's outer life to the point where there's a civilizational emergency, but just think about it from a purely selfish perspective for a moment. If you are trying to satisfy what should be an inner life quest by an outer life quest, do you even know the genuine inner life? Of course not. You aren't naturally aware of your inner life. That has to be sought and discovered. You're naturally aware of your feelings about the outer life. And so everyone has always thought, well, that's what my inner life is my feelings about the outer life. But that's not the inner life. That natural awareness of your feelings is not the inner life. The inner life is something above all of your feelings, even the most sublime feelings, even the most transcendent feelings. It's above all feelings. It's a domain of recognition, of real grounding. It's where you bind yourself back to eternity and give your life a stability that can be gotten by no other means. It certainly can't be achieved by a frantic, desperate attempt to arrange molecules in the external world until it is such a sublime, pleasant feeling that you get with that arrangement of molecules that you're certain you have discovered paradise. That it's very important what they're pointing out here. Not just because it's if you're going to have an enduring state, it has to be predicated on a genuine recognition of the ideals of statehood. Yes, but there's these other issues. What has produced the emergency is always immediately there. Between the lines of everything you're reading, that potential for you to recognize where, as a child of God, in our inescapable ignorance, we have gone astray, and don't do that anymore. You can't do anything about someone else doing it, but you can do something about you doing it. Not turning yourself inside out and getting ever more frantic about how the universe just won't obey your commands and satisfy your spiritual consciousness. Yeah. Okay, so let's jump into that paragraph, and like I said, then I'll fill out things a little bit more here.
Section 3, The Ideals of Statehood, paragraph 6. A moral society should aim to preserve the self-respect of its citizenry and afford every normal individual adequate opportunity for self-realization. Such a plan of social achievement would yield a cultural society of the highest order. Social evolution should be encouraged by governmental supervision, which exercises a minimum of regulative control. That state is best, which coordinates most while governing least.
So let's start with the first half of that paragraph. And like I said, let's look back and remind ourselves of a thread that's going through those two preceding paragraphs. You go back two paragraphs, and in the middle of there, recall how they pointed out that the exalted state compels its citizens to work. Okay? Very important. And then they added that, and not only that, but when you're moving into statehood, that means you're also moving into a phase of the development of civilization where there's going to be some genuine leisure time. And more so, that can't be frivolous time either. Right? Leisure, the final sentence of that paragraph, leisure must produce as well as consume. For instance, it can't just consume electricity, or battery life or whatever, right? So that concept, that their citizens are compelled to work, and leisure, you know, challenging leisure to also produce. And then in that immediately preceding paragraph, it started out, it said, no society has progressed very far when it permits idleness. See, so again, doubling down on that. And say, well, okay, well, what's one of the reasons why? Well, they're picking that up as we started out this paragraph this evening. A moral society should aim to preserve the self-respect of its citizenry. There's no surer way to establish and maintain self-respect than through the nobility of work. And then on top of that, like they're saying, to actually know that your leisure time isn't just squandered time, but you're producing there as well. You're contributing to society in a tangible way, work or play. Even the simplest human can do that and have a self-respect proportional to their nature. You know, whether the human nature is great or small, there can be self-respect. I'm doing what I can do. The Alpheus twins were doing what they could do. Paul was doing what he could do. They had equal self-respect. That self-respect is transcends the material differential between the Alpheus twins and Paul or Peter. So you've got that big difference in, you know, in the material, but spiritual, your self-respect is predicated on your genuine spiritual nature in the upper domain, the hourglass analogy of your mind. It's anchored on the fourth level of meaning. It's the foundation, see, for that spiritualized self up there. Genuine self-respect. You haven't falsely exalted it. You're going to think that that what should be just a floor is actually a ceiling, for instance, or, you know, everything in between, you know, as well. Okay. You have that, but it's definitely spiritual. And, that moral society, that society that is synchronized with the cosmos, has citizens who are synchronized and founded in the upper domain of their minds upon the cosmos. Okay, so just wanted to see, because you probably had forgotten that little thread, but see, that's what they're picking up on as they begin that paragraph, is that thread of the nobility of work, you know, or just, you know, in general, the nobility of producing for the greater good of the society that you are in. Okay. So after that, they throw in an additional item. You know, see in paragraph six there, the rest of that first sentence. And so this society also is supposed to afford every normal individual adequate opportunity for self-realization. Okay, well, first of all, self-realization, remember, is a much more profound word in the Urantia book than it is general parlance. We're talking about literally taking a hold of your relationship to eternity in the upper domain, realityizing yourself. See, self-realization, having a self that is predicated on eternity and then functions in time. That's your self-realization. I mean, you're not making a self out of nothing. Like, it's like, well, is that what self-realization means? You're somehow manufacturing. It's like, no, you've got a self. You just need to get it so that it's not predicating everything on time and flailing about. You need to take a hold of that relationship to eternity that you were given by grace, and build everything upon that new foundation. Now, technically, of course, you're going to be growing right upon that foundation. But you notice that, you know, we're also in the wake of those harsh, so they strike us, statements in the preceding paragraph about defective and degenerate stocks. And so in gentle passing, they're reminding you. See, notice that for every normal individual. All right. So there is a, they threw that in there to remind you that there are going to be, because there's such degeneracy on this planet, such an absence of biologic uplift and, guided improvement of the genetic stock of humanity. You literally have subhuman individuals that literally are not encircled in the Holy Spirit. Literally do not have a personality identified to them. Literally do not benefit from the Spirit of Truth. Do not have a thought adjuster. Do not have a soul. Okay. When you have an individual like that, they can't self-realize. Right? You could obviously waste a lot of time spinning your wheels trying to achieve self-realization in some individual that can't self-realize because they're not technically human. Okay. Doesn't mean that you just discard them or something, but you have to discriminate and you have to set up society, accordingly. There are a number of times when they will just throw in that little technical reminder of the modifier normal in a sentence. Every normal, person or something, they'll say. So just keep that in mind. There's an example where they're using normal in a vertical sense. So that subnormal is a vertical designation, not a horizontal. It's not a horizontal bell curve. It's a vertical level differentiation. So subnormal is subhuman in the vertical sense. In the, like I said at the end of the preceding session, degenerate is basically the vertical word, and defective is the horizontal word in that preceding paragraph. Okay, so just kind of focusing back on the positive thing, you have this, the society that is, it's not going to micromanage everything, but it is trying to see to the very fundamental issues that make sure that that you preserve the self-respect of every citizen. That's a job of the state. Okay. And it's not some micromanagey job, right? It's just, like they're pointing out, it's very simple. The state just needs to tell everyone to work, and it all kinds of happens naturally. Then as leisure gets more prevalent, the state is going to be reminding everyone, encouraging everyone to see your leisure in more and more purposeful fashion. It's not going to force you to do purposeful leisure, but it's going to try to encourage that. But you notice it does say compel about the work thing. And that harkens all the way back to some of the most ancient wisdom of he who will not work shall not eat. again, that statement, no society has progressed very far when it permits idleness. And you can't have any illusions that you have some advancing civilization if you permit idleness. You know, if you exalt idleness. There's a lot of responsibility inherent in an advancing civilization. It doesn't happen automatically. It's very much a choice, and you have to impose choices upon yourself. I choose to put myself in cooperative subordination to the greater good, and I will work. Okay. And then, hinting at the micromanaging thing. You can see they bring that up in the second half of the paragraph. Social evolution should be encouraged by governmental supervision, which exercises a minimum of regulative control. That state is best, which coordinates most while governing least. And of course, right there, if you have any objectivity about the current state of affairs, not only in this country, but many countries, no wonder there's an emergency. Because we have a lot of people on the planet that are very convinced that that state is best which governs most. All right? That you can govern your way, you can regulate people into a state of light and life. Right. And no, the more you try that, the more you're going to go in the exact opposite direction, and civilization will just completely collapse, and you're going to have to start out the whole process again towards light and life, back in the first developmental epoch, the nutrition epoch.
Yeah. In a way, we have it upside down, and people are horrified at the idea that someone can be compelled to work, yet at the same time, they have this idea that compel people to be good.
Yeah.
Compel people to do the right
thing. Yeah. It's just, see, again, and that, why do you have these people that want to compel people to be good, quote unquote, compel people to do the right thing, quote unquote, because they have everything turned inside out, and they're trying to make the material external world the domain of goodness. Right? No, that's the inner life that you haven't ever discovered. And because you haven't, you're falsely trying to make all of us your inner life and get us to dance in a pleasant way for you so that you feel like you have a good inner life. You're turned inside out. Everyone is turned inside out. So the regulative elements is that the United States, this was recognized by the founding fathers, right? They've certainly in terms of the federal government, right, that it should be at a completely minimized state, and that everyone should be always looking at ways to make it more minimum or to keep it as minimum as it started, that should be on the forefront of everyone's minds. And of course, we all know, especially over the last 100+ years, it's been in the exact opposite mode, as everyone has turned themselves inside out, and trying to make the external world satisfy their spiritual longings. So regulation minimized. Because, of course, what's happening? There has to be regulation. There has to be order. Yeah, you're imposing that on yourself. You have a recognition of your personal responsibility to the group, and you're exercising self-control. You are exercising self-control. It's not, control is not being imposed upon you. You're self-controlling. There doesn't need to be a controlling government, and that allows government to move into an advancing mode where it can take on the big picture, instead of the, you know, micromanagement of the parts, it can begin to think about the big picture. Coordinates most. Right? That holistic word, coordinate. Thinking about seeing to the favorable conditions for a system of associations of all these genuine individuals. Right? Making sure that the fullness of their associative potential in a very holistic way doesn't have any unnecessary roadblocks just in the way you've set up the institutions and stuff. And so that's it. The state is best which coordinates most while governing least. All right, and we are just so far in so many quarters from that truth. And even those that used to basically understand that have forgotten it. See, that's why there's, you know, it's not an emergency when there's sort of two camps, ones that don't get it and the ones that do. But when when more than three quarters don't get it, then you got a problem. You know, and we're probably at 90%. It's very difficult to find someone who can definitively hold on to that recognition and not unwittingly slip into, it's like, well, maybe if we just threw in this flavor of micromanagement, you know, it'll be nirvana. Yeah. Okay, what else do they say here?
The ideals of statehood must be attained by evolution, by the slow growth of civic consciousness. The recognition of the obligation and privilege of social service. At first, men assume the burdens of government as a duty, following the end of the administration of political spoilsmen. But later on, they seek such ministry as a privilege, as the greatest honor. The status of any level of civilization is faithfully portrayed by the caliber of its citizens who volunteer to accept the responsibilities of statehood.
Okay. So sure enough, the very first thing that they say in that paragraph, the ideals of statehood must be attained by evolution. Right? Not what we've been doing on an ever more sweeping scale to the point of a full-on emergency, trying to get to light and life by fiat manipulation of things. It must be attained by evolution. So there, you know, there again, like I said, in all the times that the Urantia book says must, you know, those are very immediate to why the book is here to be read in the first place. Because we're not doing what we must for civilization to endure. And you see right there, they bring in, like I said, that recognition of personal responsibility and the exercise of self-control. Right? That has to slowly grow in the minds of the individuals who are humbly supplying favorable conditions for their growth. You know, and then those grown individuals pour themselves into a collective phenomenon that advances, or at least it progresses. And by the slow growth of civic consciousness. Okay, so that's, I bring it up all the time, you know, that unfortunate opposite. What do we want? Fill in the blank. When do we want it? Now. That is not, it must be attained by evolution. See, that's the complete absence of that recognition. That's thinking that we are going to build light and life. No, the only thing that humans can build in that kind of a self-righteous mode is darkness and death. In fact, it's the only thing that any lowly being that can think this, like a Lindana deck, can build. It can't be built. You'll build the opposite when you try to be a substitute for the whole and its growth. All right, let's see. So then they give you that interesting sequence. So things start out in this very primitive mode of political, of the spoil system. As they're saying, following the end of the administration of political spoilsmen. Okay, if you don't know what that means, you hear spoils, you might think of "to the victor goes the spoils." That's okay, that's exactly the point. The basic idea of the spoil system is you have political parties, and a certain political party wins. And then everyone in that political party gets a position in the government because getting given that position, you can then manipulate that position to your profit. And that's the whole point of it all. That's the whole point of elections and winning elections. And when everyone thinks that that's why you want to win an election, is so that everyone in your party can get their positions and become rich, profit in, both literally monetarily and also in just raw power that they can exercise, that's the whole point. Oh, well, isn't that where everyone kind of is? Yeah. See, we've fallen back to where, we're at least beginning to have it, as they say there, men assume the burdens of government as a duty, George Washington saying, I've just got to do it. It's my duty. I'll go back into the trenches, and we all know those stories of them assuming that burden of duty that they felt. But that very hopeful beginning has all been lost, because everything's just fallen back, and it's back into basically just a spoil system now. And we see just extreme examples of this now, where people that basically don't really have much money at all, you put them in Congress for a few years, and they're multimillionaires. And everyone thinks that that's the point. They don't think they're doing anything wrong. It's like, well, that's the whole point. And they pat themselves on the backs for being so clever, to manipulate things so that they can get the spoils. Because that's the whole point of the game. Okay, so we got to get back. We got to get out of that again and get to duty. But then there's an ideal, right, that you can put in front of that. So that it's not just duty as an end in itself, but duty towards a goal. Later on, they will seek such ministry as a privilege. So even calling it a ministry, right? Because you're taking your spiritual nature and you're ministering it out into the world, right? It's as the greatest honor. Yeah, you had a comment.
A couple of years ago, I read that sentence about the political spoilsman. Mm-hmm. Following the end of the administration of the political spoilsman, and I just said, oh dear.
And of course, that's in all of the beginning stages, of course, that's going to be there. There's always going to be those. The material comfort era, is one of the fundamental elements is greed. Okay, you shouldn't be totally aghast, right, that there's spoilsmen in the material comfort era. See, that in itself is not a problem. Again, it's just, if there's not a core element who have transcended that and are doing it because they feel that it's their duty to do it, not that they're going to profit from this, and that's why they're doing it. See, again, as long as there's leaders that are that are predicated on that, you know, it's not an emergency that there's spoilsmen. Right? And you can get through the material comfort era. And when you get, you know, to more quality of thinking and a quest for knowledge and wisdom, it can begin to move beyond duty to, right, as a privilege and things. Right? But see, again, we're failing the test of getting through the material comfort era, and we're falling back. You know, especially in terms of leaders. You know, and, you know, you'll see that, I mean, it's gotten so much into the spoil system again and thinking that this is all proper and what it's all about, that someone who enters government and that's not why they're doing it is to get the spoils, are despised as some bizarrety at best. You know, if not, of course, just literally hated because, you know, you're going to upset the whole scheme here, guy. All right. We've got a cozy system going here. All right, so we, you know, see, we have very much exalted this again. There's very little respect for doing it for a sense of duty anymore. You know, it's people don't even consider it as a possibility. It's like, well, no, everyone is doing it for selfish gain, and so they just go and they get themselves all wrapped around the axle, trying to figure out what sort of twisted reason this person has for doing this. It's like, well, it's not a selfish reason at all, and that's just completely incomprehensible to everyone. Because it's like, well, why would anyone else do this, right? You know, especially if it's you have the whole self esteem movement, the false exaltation of the self in the me generation. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I mean, it's an inescapable thing. Okay, so that's definitely where we are. You know, no matter what level, you know, that final sentence, no matter what level you're at, you know, relatively low or quite high, the status of any level of civilization is faithfully portrayed by the caliber of its citizens who volunteer to accept the responsibilities of statehood. Again, see that recognition of personal responsibility. You know, and faithfully portrayed. Ah, see, these genuine individuals who are anchored in eternity, are predicated on the cosmos, you know, and are the cosmos, the harmony of the cosmos is coming down through them and into society, and society is advancing. But, you know, obviously, see, you know, just subtle usages of faithfully like that, you know, where you remind yourself of the, that they don't mean anything you can look up in the dictionary by that word. You know, they mean genuine faith, as revealed in the Revelation, that kind of faithfully. You know, there's lots of believing portrayals going on these days. And there's lots of passionate belief that's the predicate for everyone's actions. But what about the still unshakable foundation of faith, instead of all that frothy passion. All right, what do they give us next?
In a real commonwealth, the business of governing cities and provinces is conducted by experts and is managed just as are all other forms of economic and commercial associations of people.
Right. One little paragraph, right, one sentence to cut through all the crap that's gotten into people's heads, right, that that what you're, you know, what you're, the reason you're going into government is because you're going to realize your spiritual ideals. You know, that this is an ideological job. You know, this is something about quote unquote spiritual idealism. No, it's about material pragmatism. Right? Those who govern cities and provinces, right, are the same ones that can well handle economic and, you know, economy and commerce, economic and commercial associations of people. We've got to, you know, get back into that mode. You know, everything, see, again, like I said, because everyone is turned inside out, everything is being corrupted, you know, so that you don't, you aren't engaging the material domain with material pragmatism. You're trying to manipulate matter to satiate your spiritual idealism, so-called. See, it's actually material idealism, not genuine spiritual idealism. So it's all false idealism, and it leads everything off the cliff. You know, it's just, so they're just putting that one little thought right down there in black and white, that you don't get into government, you don't get into journalism, right, in this inside-out mode, you know, where a journalist's job is to, you know, to advocate for, you know, or to try to foster saving the world. And by saving the world, of course, like I said, what everyone is thinking there is rearrange things so that a certain arrangement of molecules gives you a pleasant feeling that you call the satisfaction of your spiritual consciousness. No, that outer life is a material domain, and it's about pragmatic issues like economics and commerce, not ideology. Not fiat imposition through regulative agencies, you know, of the state of light and life, the elimination of all unpleasantness via regulative authority. No one should ever, you know, experience that again, we say. No one should ever be ripped off by some greedy guy like that ever again. And if we have to set up an infinite regulative agency, we will do it. Right? And of course, we all lose our freedom then. Secular totalitarianism. Okay, so it's a hopeful sign if someone in government goes, well, isn't this basically a matter of economics and commerce? Like, you know, one of those main things that the government is supposed to see to is that everyone is working so there can be self-respect. If there's no self-respect, I mean, you suppose there's going to be contentment? Do you suppose people could easily so discontent if there isn't self-respect? Yeah, do you suppose that you're ripe for sedition if there isn't self-respect? So many things can be restabilized and fixed if you just get back to, it's a material pragmatic phenomenon, government. Okay, it's not this false turned inside out thing that we are trying to make it these days.
Yep. But Chris, you need self-respect if you have self-esteem.
Yeah, who needs self-respect if you have self-esteem? Right? If you have an exalted sense of the self. As long as you brought that up, let me just remind everyone once again about you know, how you can easily recognize that you've got a hierarchy, with the, a vertical hierarchy with the sequence of words self-regard, self-respect, self-esteem, self-admiration. Okay. Self-regard is on the third level of meaning. Self-respect is on the fourth level of meaning. And those are positive. If you think about moving up the levels of meaning in your initial, you know, immature primitive mode, you've got all these levels that are about the self. But when you go to the fifth is the level of selflessness. So obviously it's not going to be a positive thing if I take the self up another notch from the fourth to the fifth, right? See, I'm supposed to be transitioning there. Instead of selflessness there, I've got self. I have falsely drug it up past its proper level. And when you do that, that's self-esteem. That's what the word self-esteem refers to. It's not a positive word, it's a negative word. It's not a horrendously negative word, but it's obviously beginning. You know, everyone can, oh, that, if you take that a little bit further, that's going to be problematic, right? I mean, and you can kind of see that it's not totally horrendous, because in order to say selfless, you do have to use the word self. Okay, but it is in a negating mode. It's supposed to be in a negating mode, not a further exalting mode. Well, what happens if I go up to the sixth level of meaning? Okay, that's the level of godlikeness. What if I take myself all the way up to there and substitute myself for God? Now it's definitely problematic. See, that's self-admiration. That's self-love. And that's, you know, that's where things start to go problematic for a guy named Lucifer and everyone else that goes up there. It's just right there. You can tell you shouldn't be dragging yourself up there because it's selflessness and godlikeness.
Self-forgetting get worked in there so that you
right.
purge that. Yeah.
Right. In other words, in order to be properly related to the sixth level of meaning, right, you have to be turning your back on yourself and facing the cosmos, facing up. Right, self-forgetting. Yes. You've transcended prayer through thanksgiving to worship on the sixth level of meaning. Self-forgetting. Yep.
Yeah. It strikes me, though, when you're regarding others, I don't see quite the same danger to hold them in high esteem or to admire
right.
them.
Right. Words esteem and admiration are okay. Mm-hmm. I can admire someone. I just can't admire myself. Right? Right. Myself can't be in play. Right. Or I corrupt it. Yeah. So, again, it's just, you know, esteem, okay. But self-esteem, no. You know, it's like righteousness, yeah, that's a great thing. Self-righteousness, not so much. Makes a big difference you put self-hyphen in front of the word. Okay, yeah, you had something too? Okay. Anyway, back to the text. So, yeah. Again, see, when you turn everything inside out, it's not going to be about material pragmatism. It's going to be about false spiritual idealism. It's going to be about material idealism. Right? That whole falsehood and everything is torn apart by that. No, economics, commerce, someone who probably has an innate ability in that regard and has a lot of experience that's built up a high skill level, and then they can go in and be very effective in that economic commercial setting. not in that ideological setting. Okay. All right, remember, you know, you're voting for the president, you're not voting for your high priest. Okay. You're not voting for someone who's going to tend to your so-called inner life. All right. This paragraph, I mean, it's, you know, it's the case what they're saying there for the Congress. It's even more so, right, for the president. Okay.
In advanced states, political service is esteemed as the highest devotion of the citizenry. The greatest ambition of the wisest and noblest of citizens is to gain civil recognition, to be elected or appointed to some position of governmental trust, and such governments confer their highest honors of recognition for service upon their civil and social servants. Honors are next bestowed in the order named upon philosophers, educators, scientists, industrialists, and militarists. Parents are duly rewarded by the excellency of their children, and purely religious leaders, being ambassadors of a spiritual kingdom, receive their real rewards in another world.
maybe I should just comment on that very last line first, since it fits into what I was saying, you know, that whole bit about our false turning things inside out. Right. You know, electing a president to be your religious leader, to be your high priest. No, right? You know, again, if it's a genuine religious leader, and as they're pointing out, if it's a purely religious leader, right, that's about spirit, not matter. Okay? And their real rewards are in another world, as it were. Okay, but let's back up to the beginning. Right there in the very first sentence, you saw it. In advanced states, okay, so we've gone back, you know, the early phase of the progress of civilization into an advancing phase. In advanced states, political service is esteemed. Right? The word esteemed, right, is okay. Not self-esteem. Right, it's esteemed as the highest devotion of the citizenry. So, you know, because, you know, it's gone into that mode where it's this ministry you know, that you are privileged to participate in. You feel greatly honored that you have managed to achieve such a level of self-control, of self-mastery, of the embodiment of wisdom with a predicate of truth, that they would give you this position. They recognize your great integrity, how much you are founded on the harmony and the integrity of the cosmos, and should be the leader. You should be put in a position of trust, as you're trustworthy. Greatest ambition of the wisest and noblest. See, and there's that noble word. Again, when they use that, okay, think vertical. Right? See, so someone that is genetically cut above the rest, right? And has greater potentials that can be actualized, and they have been actualized as a wise individual. You know, but great humility in the midst of all that. A recognition of your abilities and what you can do, but humble in the face of God. Right, like I say, in terms of that godlikeness level, there's no self there. All right, and so obviously, see that, you know, if all that is in place, that is where the society's highest honor obviously will go. Those are the most exemplary individuals. They not only have the philosophic nature, they have a personal living philosophy of high caliber, as they mentioned, at the upper domain of their, the hourglass analogy of their mind is a high caliber personal living philosophy. They not only have that, but they have the means to associate that down through the lower domain and out to the world in a very effective way. So they've got the whole package. I mean, they're primed and they're encircuited, right? And the cosmos is flowing down through them and out to the world. So the highest honor goes there. And then you see that they give that list, you know, in the order named, they say. Right? So what order is this? This is top down. Right? Who are the, you know, there's the philosophers that are actually in action, like we just said. Okay, then there's the philosophers. That's the next notch down. Right? And then, see, all education is predicated on that philosophic context. Right. So that comes. That's the next notch down, and then scientists see are down again. You know, you very much see that the sphere of philosophy is encompassing all aspects of the society, not religion. Right? I mean, if, as you point out, that's a totally separate issue. Right. But philosophers, educators, scientists, and then, of course, you put that scientific knowledge into play as industrialists. All right, and you put that industry into play as the militarists. It's just taking it top down. Yeah. Each word is predicated on the prior. Okay, so... So you see, you have a society that very much recognizes the genuine vertical hierarchy of things. You know, and then of course they throw in, well, where does parenting fit into that? That's not, you know, industry or science or, well, again, that's a foundational element. We've gotten to the point of a statehood that has citizens. And we've been talking about how all of the integrity of the state is predicated on integrous citizens. Parents are duly rewarded by the excellency of their children. Their children are brought into relationship with the cosmos and are a foundation for a reflection of the cosmos and a civilization. So, and you see, religion is the whole point there, and purely religious leaders, that's just those who are fostering that initiation of that cosmic citizen. Before there's a developed cosmic citizen, there's a cosmic citizen that starts. Religion... is that initiation, you know, getting you engaged to the initiator, to the Universal Father, to initiate you as a human. Okay, so it's all there. Very, very great way they end it there. So, see, those ideals, so they've given you that, you know, a society can know that that's what it's striving for. Is the manifestation, the collective recognition of this hierarchy, this vertical nature, you know, and everything that goes with it. You know, and finally leaving the crudeness of self that is the spoiled system far, far, far behind. All right. We start to move in now to some sections that are building to some very interesting elements in the Revelation about the whole vertical nature in the highest sense that we can really attempt to wrap our minds around right now. Recognition of the physics of that whole vertical nature, that once you are initiated as a genuine human, and like we were saying, that you move into becoming an embodiment of philosophy, an embodiment of truth, you moving up through levels of wisdom, culminating in a very high estate, sort of the highest estate that you can really imagine for oneself right now, as that's achievable as a mortal. we won't get to the fullness of that tonight, but they're gonna start to build up to it here. And then you see we've got a list here, a big long list that we're gonna go through. So let's jump into this section and see what we've got.
Number four, progressive civilization, economics, society, and government must evolve if they are to remain. Static conditions on an evolutionary world are indicative of decay. Only those institutions which move forward with the evolutionary stream persist.
You often hear me refer to the, you know, main evolutionary stream. You see, I'm using that term directly there. You know, if they are to remain, period. You know, <what's> that? Right? Like, we're talking existential here, right? Just not if they're going to remain, whatever. You know, just remain, period. They must evolve because it's a fundamentally evolutionary domain. Nothing is real if it isn't part of the evolutionary system. There isn't any other system outside of the central universe. And, of course, that's the whole point. We're not in the central universe. And so as your spiritual consciousness advances and you start to get some awareness of fairly transcendent things, I've pointed this out many times. You get into this mode where you're falsely wanting to existentialize things. And all the way to the point of kind of going to the core of the existential stasis. You know, and believing that that's what you're trying to achieve here is this divine stasis of an arrangement of molecules. They're just sweeping that away. Static conditions. Okay, let's imagine you somehow do that. You know, you get a really secular totalitarian state set up. That's not a state anymore, really, then. But just a dictatorship or whatever. And you achieve this divine static state that you desire. Well, on an evolutionary world, that's indicative of decay. Because we're not at the core of existential reality, the stasis of deity. Right? We're in an evolutionary domain. And it's either going with that or it's becoming steadily more and more unreal until it ceases to exist. Just the very fact that the Supreme is evolving means that when we've got ourselves turned inside out like this, and we're trying to make the outside eternity instead of the inside, right, the stasis of eternity on the outside, it's not just going to bring everything to a grinding halt, it's actually going to decay. And see, so that's why there's an emergency. It's not that you're just putting things in suspended animation and it's like, well, somewhere down the road it'll start moving again. That's not the way it works, the physics of reality. It decays, and that's what we talk about all the time. Everything is obviously decaying. you know, we've decayed back to almost 100% spoil system and all these things. Everything is decaying rapidly, you know, and it's, you know, you've got a spiritual energy behind this, so it's an exponential decay. It's a geometric decay. And as I've pointed out, you know, it was decaying and decaying, and then you could start to really see the exponential curve picking up, you know, in the 80s, 90s to now. Okay, so that's what's going on. It's just failure to recognize everything has to evolve. Everything. Your relationship to spirit has to evolve. Everything has to evolve. And if it's not, it's decaying.
I need some moral hygiene. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Clear away the truth decay.
One could say that. Okay, so, you know, and we saw this way back in the biology. Remember when we were talking about evolutionary biology? Way back in those initial historical geology papers, basically. Remember how they said basically the same thing, only those institutions which move forward with the evolutionary stream persist? Right? Only those species that move forward with the evolutionary stream persist. All the other ones are not upheld anymore, and they cease to exist. There's lots and lots of extinctions of species because they aren't moving forward with the evolutionary stream. You know, and so any institutions will suffer the same fate as those species, those countless species that no longer exist. It doesn't matter if you're talking about biology, so, you know, society, everything evolves and it has those same rules. Okay, so that's what they're priming up. And the title here, Progressive Civilization, remember I bring that up all the time with the indispensables. You know, those indispensables to the progress of civilization. Oh, I bet we're getting close to our fourth indispensable in the first phase. We'll get there in a little bit here.
The progressive program of an expanding civilization embraces 1. Preservation of individual liberties. 2. Protection of the home. 3. Promotion of economic security. 4. Prevention of disease. 5. Compulsory education. 6. Compulsory employment. 7. Profitable utilization of leisure. 8. Care of the unfortunate. 9. Race improvement. 10. Promotion of science and art. 11. Promotion of philosophy, wisdom. 12. Augmentation of cosmic insight, spirituality.
Okay. So just before we look at any of the details, notice the heading on the list. A progressive program of an expanding civilization embraces. There's lots of people who have discovered the word progress and have become very delighted with that concept. And they call themselves progressives, but they really aren't. Right? They're progressivists. They're believers in a false doctrine called progressivism. They're saying instead of that false doctrine, okay, what does a valid progressive program look like? Instead of the false one that people are destroying civilization with in the name of progress. Okay, so note that little element there. There's a little teaching there in parallel with another spot in the book where they point out all of the fallacies of progressivism. We'll eventually get to that down many papers away here yet. But just look at some of those things. I mean, you know, you notice some that, like race improvement, of course, you know, leaps out at you. But maybe, you know, maybe the first thing to notice, remember how all of this is predicated on the three cosmic intuitions? Right? Education, civilization, personality, you know, you name it, religion. You know, the final paragraph of paper 16, section 6. The purpose, all those things. I see the augmentation of cosmic insight, spirituality. You know, one of the parallels with that false doctrine of progressivism is the false doctrine of positivism. Fundamental tenet of which is there is no such thing as cosmic insight. So you, not surprisingly, things are. In the name of progress, things are actually going the other direction. Because you don't have the foundational cosmic predicate for anything to be progressing. All right, the cosmos is progressing, and you're trying to bring that cosmos as above, so below. Trying to bring that progress of the cosmos down through cosmically attuned individuals out into society, and it will progress. It'll strike step with the cosmos. The only way to do that is to take delight in cultivating, engaging the cosmos with your three cosmos engagers, right? The three cosmic intuitions, your three insights. Again, the promotion of philosophy is that all-encompassing, you know, or that umbrella over everything. I mean, the care of the unfortunate is in there. You know, you may remember back there, though, it said you don't want if the defective and degenerate stocks are freely supported, okay, right? You care for the unfortunate, but you don't freely support them. And, you know, in other words, remember what the context was there. At the very least, they need work. If they're going to get support from the government, I got to work for it. Right? You're going to get welfare, you're going to get Medicaid. Right? You got to work for it. Right? So there's, you know, it's reminding you of that right here in the Revelation. You know, you notice several things we saw back there. The profitable utilization of leisure is in there, see again. Compulsory employment is there again. You know, we saw. So many things were predicated. Remember, we went through that list of 10 back there in section 2, and we had freedom of the mind. Unless a free people are educated, taught to think intelligently and plan wisely, freedom usually does more harm than good. Right? So, of course, you've got compulsory education in here. Promotion of economic security. Right? Some of these things, you know. We obviously have all kinds of tensions around a number of these elements. Should be very obvious to anyone that's paying any attention to what's going on in the political sphere these days. Protection of the home, right? Is the home being protected? No, the home is under full assault, et cetera. Okay.
They use the term expanding civilization.
Mm-hmm.
When I read this, I get this picture of a sphere.
Uh-huh.
And the first and last are like at the poles. And the equator, the line between, everything, the first six are foundational, the second six are aspirational.
Mm.
But material gravity tends to pull everything down.
Yep.
So for this to be integrous, all of these have to be in play. And it's like a big balloon.
Mm-hmm.
If any one is deficient, all the air is going to fall out. It's going to flatten them.
Mm-hmm.
Flatten them and come back down.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, and just Yeah, I mean, that was another, you know, I wasn't going to get into a lot of the physics of all this, but, you know, but that's great. You're reflecting, you know, you can reflect a lot on the patterns. So obviously, 12 items, there's opportunity for a lot of pattern recognition there. But just, again, how simple-minded some people can be in the name of progress. Thinking, well, we're just going to tend to this one little issue, and it's going to be like magical. Things are going to progress. It's like, no, no, it's a very complex system. You have to think very holistically about it, or things won't genuinely progress. It feeds back into that change without growth is potential evil. See, there's a wholeness to growth, and there's a complexity encompassed by wholeness that has to all be considered. All be encompassed. You notice that civilization embraces, right? You're wrapping yourself around it, right? There's a whole with lots of parts that are being encompassed. Yeah, so a whole bunch of things you can recognize there. And obviously, like you're pointing out, you know, the next step, once you sort of get the basic philosophic recognition about what they're saying, is to start getting into the science of it. The science of a progressive program, a true science of progress instead of the false science of progress that we're exercising right now. That goes under the banner of progressivism. I was like, well, couldn't we just do all of them except number 9? Again, like we just said, nope, it's not going to work. Because we saw how many things are predicated on genetics. Right. Poverty is a genetic issue.
Yeah, systems don't work. Parts are okay here. Right. Not so good there. Not a good system anymore.
Yeah. Anyway, so very fascinating. I mean, just notice what they're pushing into a pretty high degree of detail in some of these areas, which is very interesting. See, so, the fact that they give you a list of 12 like this is because we can't figure it all out ourselves. Right? Or they wouldn't be allowed to give you all that. And again, you can kind of see, it's like, well, okay, that's pretty obvious, because like we were just saying, it's complicated. And we don't have the big picture yet, and that's the job of revelation, is to give you that big picture that you can't achieve as a lowly little child of God. But once you're given that, it's like, okay, I get it now. And you know, once they give you the 12 parts, then you can start to analyze the 12 parts and understand the mechanics of the 12 parts. But boy, they needed to tell you there's 12 parts to start with, so you didn't think, well, I think there's 6, or whatever, right?
One thing about this listing vertical, like from the bottom up as you go, art is always the last thing that's on the budget, and it's always the first thing to go in schools and stuff. I mean,
yeah, and obviously in the details of every one of those, exactly what is race improvement? And how do you know if you're doing something that improves it or not? Obviously the promotion of false science and false art is not going to lead to progress. An awful lot, like I said, I mean, an awful lot of this is predicated on a very objective recognition. That vertical recognition that's required for even the beginnings of genuine art to be in existence. Something that's oriented toward the Marantia? Really? and of course we all know, I mean, there was some that were tending that way, but again, it's turned 180 degrees, and so much of art is, you know, willfully oriented towards the most basal, depraved thing that the individual can think of. Okay. Anyway.
Instead of paint roller against a surface.
Okay. What else do they tell us here?
And this progress in the arts of civilization leads directly to the realization of the highest human and divine goals of mortal endeavor, the social achievement of the brotherhood of man, and the personal status of God consciousness, which becomes revealed in the supreme desire of every individual to do the will of the Father in heaven.
So, in this whole progressive program, it not only is the society, the group progressing, but all the individuals are progressing upward, all the way to the heights of God consciousness. And you've heard me mention this a number of times, but you can see it very directly here. God consciousness is not what you think it is when you first read that in Revelation. There isn't anyone that has ever had the slightest clue of what the revelators are referring to when they say God consciousness. At best, humans have had vague inklings of God knowingness. God knowingness is the beginning. God consciousness is your potential peak status that you can strive toward as a mortal, or even as moving up through the mansion worlds. Okay, God consciousness is very, very high in the cosmic system, the cosmic scheme of things. And your first challenge is to get to square one, to get to God knowingness on the sixth level of meaning, to get from down in the lower domain believing in some notion of God, which is definitely not God consciousness, and it's not even God knowingness, to move up through the objective levels of meaning to get up to God knowingness, separate faith from belief, those sorts of things, found yourself in reality consciously, and then through a vast system of levels of wisdom to culminate in this very high estate that they term God consciousness. And you can tell it's pretty ceiling dweller stuff, because which becomes revealed in the finite desire? No, in the supreme desire. See, so to get to God consciousness is to fraternize with supremacy. A long journey up from your lowly finite starting point. So hold that out as a mysterious, distant goal that you got plenty of growing to do to achieve. There's lots of favorable conditions that need to be supplied. Not to mention you're going up levels of wisdom, and the only way that you can get wisdom is through tribulation. Right? The road from God knowingness to God consciousness is paved with just ever heightening tribulation to achieve ever heightening wisdom. It's going to take some courage, courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Feast on adversity. Right? Oh. Yeah. We all know how it goes, right? And the God conscious thing, you know, some of the mechanics of that is coming up later in this paper. All right. So anyway, so just, you know, see that there's, you know, the social achievement of the brotherhood of man and the personal status of God consciousness. So, you know, that there's greater and greater interplay. The more there is in the individual, the more there can be. You know, more there is within, the more there can be without. The more there is without, the more there can be within. And the more there is within, the more there can be without. And right, you set up a dynamic interplay between the inner life and the outer life, and both are elevating.
So this knowingness entry point, God knowingness, mm-hmm. kind of what you would maybe consider to be your first acceptable idea. Something that's not just a natural idea of the
ghost fear idea and all of that. But the first feeling of a real idea.
It's an objectively validated, real beginning.
Yeah.
It's a self-evident recognition. You don't know about some notion of God. You know God.
Yeah.
You know, it obviously is predicated on that faith grasp, that personal recognition of the faith grasp, not a belief. All right.
The appearance of genuine brotherhood signifies that a social order has arrived in which all men delight in bearing one another's burdens. They actually desire to practice the golden rule. But such an ideal society cannot be realized when either the weak or the wicked lie in wait to take unfair and unholy advantage of those who are chiefly actuated by devotion to the service of truth, beauty, and goodness. In such a situation, only one course is practical. The golden rulers may establish a progressive society in which they live according to their ideals while maintaining an adequate defense against their benighted fellows who might seek either to exploit their pacific predilections or to destroy their advancing civilization.
Okay, pretty in your face balance and proportion between spiritual idealism on the one hand, material pragmatism on the other hand. while maintaining an adequate defense against their benighted fellows, material pragmatism. Okay. It's like, well, I like to imagine that everyone is such that I don't. Yeah, well, that's a wonderful imagining you've got going there, but that's not reality. You know, there's an awful lot of people that get up every day and are scheming on how they can take advantage of your fuzzy thinking. Either in a big collective fashion, you know, from totally without the country, you know, or lots of one scheming within, as they're pointing out. It's not, you know, the weak or the wicked. You know, wait to take unfair and unholy advantage. You know, and it's like, whoa, there's this country with all these golden rulers, and they have these very high ideals. Whoa, what an opportunity. You know, I just can go there, this other country, and they'll just give me stuff. Because they're really kind of guilty. They feel a lot of guilt about how they have a more advanced civilization than I do from the country I came from. And boy, I could easily take unfair advantage of their predilections. It's going on in spades.
Not if his knees are broken.
The golden rulers, what few there are on the planet are about to be overwhelmed by the black flood of the weak and the wicked. The darkness, right, and death of civilization. So it's right there again. One has to have a cosmic consciousness, not just a spiritual consciousness that quickly goes to complete falsehood, like we've been saying, off on this false tangent. All right, and then they double down here, give you a little bit more.
Idealism can never survive on an evolving planet if the idealists in each generation permit themselves to be exterminated by the baser orders of humanity. And here is the great test of idealism. Can an advanced society maintain that military preparedness which renders it secure from all attack by its war-loving neighbors without yielding to the temptation to employ this military strength in the offensive operations against the offensive operations against other peoples for purposes of selfish gain or national aggrandizement? National survival demands preparedness, and religious idealism alone can prevent the prostitution of preparedness into aggression. Only love, brotherhood, can prevent the strong from oppressing the weak.
So a couple things there. I mean, one, notice, you know, I mean, that opening sentence, of course, is what I, you know, often refer to, at least in a paraphrase it, that idealism can never survive. You know, when idealism finally begins to evolve on a world, it will quickly die unless, right, there's this cosmic balance that comes into play. Idealism can never survive, you know, not seldom survives, can never survive on an evolving planet if the idealists in each generation permit themselves to be exterminated by the baser orders of humanity. Right. No beating around the bush, just state it flat on, the baser orders of humanity. So none of this all men are born equal stuff. Right? There are baser orders of humanity. Guess what? There's even baser orders than the baser orders of humanity. There's literally subhumans. Okay. You know, there aren't countries filled with them or anything, but they are scattered about through all the countries. You know, so you can be brought down from within or without, or both. As they were hinting at in the preceding paragraph. Okay, so, and obviously they need to throw in, it's not like they're sort of just pounding mercilessly upon the idealists on the planet, those who have some spiritual consciousness. Right? I mean, there's a point. Yeah, I mean, you got to make sure that if you have a definitive military, that it doesn't just go running off into militarism, right, and tries to become a complete lifestyle solution, right, and becomes an offensive thing, which means you're going back, you know, you're trying to move into the advancing domain of civilization, you know, where you're leaving war behind. See, leaving war behind as that offensive mode of action. I mean, especially on this planet where we have people spread out all over the developmental spectrum in terms of civilization, you know, you're going to have war as a defensive thing, even when you're pushing forward. All right, so war, you know, in a world like ours, where everything is, in a normal world, everything's pretty tight and everyone is moving out of war kind of altogether. You know, but on this world, you know, war is going to move into the more advanced stages, you know, or tail into the more advanced stages more than on a normal world because of this defensive need. You know, you got people that haven't hardly gotten started on civilization yet, so war is just completely indispensable to them, and you know, and you can't keep them bottled up in some spot on the planet anymore, so, you know, it's problematic.
It's a real problem for an idealist because you tend to project your idealism. So you abhor war, so you assume that everyone else does also.
Yeah.
No, that's not so. Right. You might abhor war, but those other people, they may not abhor it at all. They're breaking at the bit.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mentioned war-loving neighbors.
Yeah.
War-loving neighbors, right? Right. This is their whole spiritual motivation, as it were, right, in their primitive estate. Yeah, and again, you know, you mentioned projection. Yeah, again, Stop turning things inside out. Right? Your idealism, if it's true, is spiritual idealism. It has absolutely nothing to do with the outer life of matter. Right? It's a pure inner life matter. Pardon the pun. Right?
I don't think I can forget it.
Again, don't turn inside out so that you get into materialized. Then the idealist, quote unquote, won't have a problem. The reason the idealist has a problem is because it's material idealism he's thinking about, not spiritual idealism. There is no tension between spiritual idealism and material pragmatism. There's lots of tension between material pragmatism and material idealism. False idealism. Don't you dare give me some pragmatic thing. This is about ideals. That tension that we're constantly wrestling with. I apologize for kind of pounding on this because it is wearing. But it's just that's why the revelation is here, is because we just. If I don't serve as a hammer upon the anvil, remember what they tell you. Well, then celestial beings will serve as the hammer on the anvil. It will be pounded into our thick skulls one way or another. Right, we've got to get this through our heads. We've got to stop doing this. We've got to stop turning things inside out like this. Okay.
I'm in the world around here.
No, I know what you meant. But I was just chiming in on that. Good point. And one other little thing to notice there. Do you notice a little twist, the interesting twist they threw in towards the end there? How you prevent it from going to this aggressive, offensive material or militarism? National survival demands preparedness and religious idealism alone. See, so that they I keep saying spiritual idealism, they're reminding you, okay, I mean, that's in the sphere of a personal nature. That whole spiritual but not religious, see, again, is taking us astray in this regard. I mean, that spiritual idealism has to be personal spiritual idealism. It has to be religious idealism. Not just fancy animal spiritual idealism.
Or just a zeal without any
wisdom. Right. See, so you just notice how they threw that little in, that little tweak. I should have caught you. It's like, oh, religious idealism. Right? Again, genuine religion has a very important role to play in society. Okay. Keeping the inner life inner. Right? Religion's job is to make sure that everyone is constantly reminded that the inner life is inside. Just like the name says. Okay, not outside. All right.
5. The evolution of competition. Competition is essential to social progress, but competition, unregulated, breeds violence. In current society, competition is slowly displacing war in that it determines the individual's place in industry, as well as decreeing the survival of the industries themselves. Murder and war differ in their status before the mores. Murder having been outlawed since the early days of society, while war has never yet been outlawed by mankind as a whole.
Yeah, remember there, that parenthetical is reminding you, we brought this up some. We get all wrapped around the axle about this. It's like, well, I thought it's thou shalt not kill. Well, okay, it's thou shalt not murder. Okay, it's different if you're a soldier and your job, in an impersonal fashion is to kill the enemy, okay? Thou shalt not, doesn't have anything to do with that. It's about, individual revenge, thou shalt not murder. okay, but the other thing, if you're going to leave war behind, well, exactly how do you do that? They're reminding you competition. So think about how the same people that are constantly howling about how horrible war is also demonize competition. And they don't know that they're fighting against themselves. If you want war to be left behind, you have to encourage competition to take its place. But again, all of these false idealists, who have turned themselves inside out, look at competition. It's like, oh, that's so mean and debased. And so war is better. We could always go back to war if you don't like competition. Remember, even local universes are pitted against each other in competition. Right? On local universe headquarters level, there's competition between local universes. And competition isn't some absolute evil, like false idealists declare it to be. The angels in our local universe are in intense competition with angels from other local universes to see who can be the most perfectly synchronized with the cosmos in their actions. The most holistic parts. All right. Let's see. But, obviously, right, there has to be some regulation like they're throwing in. Government has a role. Unregulated competition breeds violence, okay? And we saw them pointing out how you've got to, in the list there, you've got to make sure that it doesn't go that way, right? But again, competition should be promoted. And the degree to which people don't self-regulate, it's going to have to be regulated some. And especially in the earliest stages when there isn't as much self-regulation as there is in the later stages.
Yeah. Our tendency is to think in dichotomies. So
yeah.
We think of competition bad, cooperation good. Well, but how cooperation eventually gains the upper hand is because it gives one group a competitive advantage over another group.
Not to mention, there's a degree of cooperation in a competition.
Right.
Right. If you have a competition in a sport, the two sides are on the same field. They're cooperating and showing up at the same field at the same time.
And coordinated.
and putting themselves under the coordination of the rules of the game. And right. Again, it's not a dichotomy. All right.
The ideal state undertakes to regulate social conduct only enough to take violence out of the individual competition and to prevent unfairness in personal initiative. Here's a great problem in statehood. How can you guarantee peace and quiet in industry, pay the taxes to support state power, and at the same time prevent taxation from handicapping industry and keep the state from becoming parasitical or tyrannical?
Again, see, we're dealing with these things, and we have lots of ignorance about this, because we think in dichotomies, for instance. Taxation can handicap industry. But there's a lot of people that don't seem to have any recognition of that fact. And so the state becomes this parasite on industry, sucking all the life out of it. And the moment that you take some of the tax burden off it, ta-da! The organism comes alive again when the parasite isn't attached to it. It's not rocket science. Like I pointed out, again, regulate. It's always, you know, at the minimal level, and as they're pointing out, only enough to take violence out of the picture. And notice the really problematic one, the rest of that. Say, violence out of the individual competition and to prevent unfairness in personal initiative. Personal initiative, not results. Right? We're trying to regulate so that the results are fair. Not the initiation. Not the beginning, the ending is quote unquote fair. And of course that's leading to, you know, secular totalitarianism.
Battle cry of equality.
Right. Personal initiative, right? Because liberty, preservation of individual liberties was number one over there in that list. Right? The liberty of initiative. Okay. How it plays out, that's a complicated thing. And it's not going to be quote-unquote fair. Someone who's better at it will have more success than someone who isn't. Well, that's not fair, everyone cries. Everyone should get the same result. I mean, even the person that doesn't do anything should get just as much benefit as the person who, you know, devotes every waking moment of their life. Yeah, well, we're definitely struggling with that one. Okay, what else do they say here?
Throughout the earlier ages of any world, competition is essential to progressive civilization. As the evolution of man progresses, cooperation becomes increasingly effective. In advanced civilizations, cooperation is more efficient than competition. Early man is stimulated by competition. Early evolution is characterized by the survival of the biologically fit. But later civilizations are the better promoted by intelligent cooperation, understanding fraternity, and spiritual brotherhood.
See, and again, like Gene was pointing out, okay, it's not a dichotomy. Right. There's rudimentary cooperation, you know, in the beginnings of competition. It's an evolution of exactly the balance in the system of the two, if you will. And obviously, like I pointed out, you know, you don't get to the point where there is no competition at all in any way, shape, or form. You're going to ascend to competition on the headquarters of the local universe. Okay, so, you know, obviously there are certain things where it is a very efficient way to stimulate what's going on. And remember, I mentioned this whole bit about between local universes. Remember, those are, you know, in many ways separate wholenesses unto themselves, right? It's one thing internally, but between, you know, very long-standing integrous elements, it's like we pointed out, nations, you know, persist well, you know, way into light and life. You don't evaporate nations away until, you know. So you've got standing differential there, right? In the contrast between them, the competition between them. Just like the contrast between two local universes, right? You don't melt local universes together. They stand apart. You know, at least as far as everyone can envision, you know, they're certainly going to be there until the grand universe is settled in life. Who knows what happens after that, right? But so just, you know, see, Thinking about that, I mean, competition is inherent, like they're pointing out, is essential to progressive civilization. Remember that differential, right, that makes civilization progress? It's inherent in a differential. All right.
True. Competition in industry is exceedingly wasteful and highly ineffective, but no attempt to eliminate this economic lost motion, but no attempt to eliminate this economic lost motion should be countenanced if such adjustments entail even the slightest abrogation of any of the basic liberties of the individual.
See how fundamental the liberties of the individual are again. See, you know, even the slightest abrogation is tyranny. You must allow the full fullness of self-realization and its expression outward into the system. Right? That's the source of the progress of the collective phenomenon. Right? If you turn off the spigot, water doesn't flow anymore. It's as simple as that. All right, let's... You got this other little paragraph, so you get that really strong one about competition, and then you get about profit.
6, the profit motive. Present day profit motivated economics is doomed unless profit motives can be augmented by service motives. Ruthless competition based on narrow minded self interest is ultimately destructive of even those things which it seeks to maintain. Exclusive and self-serving profit motivation is incompatible with Christian ideals, much more incompatible with the teachings of Jesus.
Little jab there. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, they threw in Christian ideals. I mean, it's like, okay, it's a... At the very least, you should be able to maintain the Christian ideals of the nation upon which it was founded. I'm one nation under God. Not to mention, if you actually bring in the genuine teachings of Jesus. But you know that issue aside for the moment. So profit, and you notice how they start out sort of acknowledging what our idealistic consciousness has begun to recognize more and more. How there's a harshness here that doesn't seem to be compatible with your contemplation of eternity. Okay, and that they're validating that. Okay, but they're also pointing out, don't think of them as a dichotomy. Profit motive and service motive are not a dichotomy. See, your profit motive is augmented by service motive. Right? They're not at absolute odds with one another in a dichotomy. You can blend them together. And so there's just like matter and spirit can be woven together in a whole spectrum of ratios as morantia substance.
Profitably.
Yes. Profit motive and service motive can be woven together in a whole spectrum of proportions. Okay, and so you want to think about it, you know, an evolutionary phenomenon where you evolve in more and more service motive as profit motive naturally evolves away. All right.
Which it couldn't do if it weren't profitable in service.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be profit in service.
Right. Right. Obviously, this service motive is profiting civilization. You know, they're just stressing. See, you're just shifting it from merely profiting an individual selfishly to profiting the group. That's the whole point. We're expanding out from island universe individuals into a collective system of individuals. Okay.
In economics, profit motivation is to service motivation what fear is to love in religion. But the profit motive must not be suddenly destroyed or removed. It keeps many otherwise slothful mortals hard at work. It is not necessary, however, that this social energy arouser be forever selfish in its objectives.
Okay. So, you know, when you see fear and love, you know, you probably have a tendency to put fear and love in a dichotomy too. Remember? But you can't start out religion as anything but a religion of fear. That is initial religion. There is no other religion than that. Right? They're just pointing out the same thing. I mean, you can't start anywhere except with initially quite selfishly oriented profit motive. But you evolve it forward. I mean, if nothing else, you know, you can think about how you evolve fear up in the lower domain from just raw fear in the zeroth level of meaning up through anguish and dread into awe and reverence on the second level of meaning. Right? Reverence is still fear. It's just fear anew. It's re-fear. The word is literally re-fear, revere. Right? So, see, your whole initial relationship to religion, you know, is moving up through fear. Just like, as I'm pointing out, it's the same thing, moving up through profit. But it's an ever more exalted mode of profit, just like it's an ever more exalted mode of fear. And then you begin to reciprocate and move into a more transcendent mode. Okay. But it has to be a continuous evolution, not some disjoint, step function.
This transition from profit motive to service motive has to be internal.
Yeah,
that has to be the driver. It can't be. Can't do it externally first.
Yeah,
it has to. What happens externally, it really just flows. Because two people can be doing the same job and motivated differently.
Yeah.
It's...
And of course, you know, just think about that. You're exactly correct. You know, we've been pointing out how this whole civilization is ever more predicated on a profound individual, a cosmic individual. And so this should remind you, it's like, well, what would it take to get from profit motive individuals to service motive individuals? Oh, wait a minute. What about that free service and liberty loving devotion? Oh, I've got to get from first milers to second milers. Right? It's delusional to think that you're going to have service motive with a bunch of first milers.
Or love and religion, for that
matter. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, the first milers at best languish and stumble along in moral darkness. That doesn't sound like advancing civilization. Okay. All right. So you have to be very clear-eyed about this. This is a big thing. You know, it's not some, I'm just going to flip it. You're talking about something like you're pointing out that's profound, right? It's this is service that's predicated on genuine love, not on feelings, right? And since no one, you know, really knows what love, genuine love is, we've got a long ways to go. Right? How can you know what genuine love is if you can't look up the proper definition of faith in the dictionary? Since faith is the initiation of all the genuine definitions of all these things. Right, again, we have a long ways to go to get to the starting point. So when you read this, your idealism goes, oh, wow, that feels so wonderful. Service motive instead of profit motive. Yeah, it feels. Right, that's how you're judging it, is by your feelings. Right? But it's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. If you're going to get to genuine service motive, feelings are not going to get you there. Right? It's reflective thinking that's going to get you there. It's a philosophic mind that's going to get you there. So you definitely need to get out of the material comfort area and be getting into the quest for knowledge and wisdom if you're going to be definitively making this transition to more and more service motive woven into the profit motive society. All right, let's wrap it up here.
The profit motive of economic activities is altogether base and wholly unworthy of an advanced order of society. Nevertheless, it is an indispensable factor throughout the early phases of civilization. Through the earlier phases of civilization. Profit motivation must not be taken away from men until they have firmly possessed themselves of superior types of non-profit motives for economic striving and social serving. The transcendent urges of superlative wisdom, intriguing brotherhood, and excellency of spiritual attainment.
See, like I was saying, those second miler qualities, right, that they're listing at the end there. But there it is. Our fourth indispensable of the progress, indispensable to the progress of the early phase of civilization. Yes, if you're crossing into advancing civilization, you've got to begin to be leaving that behind, or shifting the proportion between the two, as it were. but nevertheless, right, and it's indispensable, right, in those earlier phases. So we've got the four indispensables now: slavery, war, social classes, profit motive. Indispensables to the early phase. And true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness are the second four for the advanced phase. Oh, he was stressing that God consciousness thing was way, way, way. Yeah, see, that's why it's the fourth one. Right, it's taking you to, a supremacy of civilization. That God consciousness is the final of the second four, predicated on superlative wisdom. Right, you're going to have an intriguing brotherhood of man on the planet, an excellency of spiritual attainment.
The same paucity about service that we have about love.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Right. We don't know really loving service. We know feelingful service. And it's feelings about your outer life. You see, it's material predicated service, not spiritual predicated service. There's no excellency of spiritual attainment. There's no spiritual attainment at all. It's just material. Okay. And, it's an issue that needs to be dealt with material pragmatism, but could you have something, could you have a genuine internal predicate to your service instead of just, there's an external world, it feeds in as a feeling and then feeds back out as you moving your hands and legs in some way? Right? Are you just a helpless victim of antecedent causation in your service? Or are you original? Is it coming down through your personality? Are you a source of service that can only come through your absolutely unique personality? Or are you just recycling the external world through you?
Yeah. A hamster can do that.
Yeah.
His antecedent causation is the wheels coming back under his leg.
Okay, so... So there, yep. So then we will get into what I was hinting at next time about They give us some of the physics of just how much relationship to the cosmos, how much wisdom you have to move up through to even begin to have God consciousness as a goal. Right? All right. We'll probably be wrapping this up and moving into all of the complexities. You want to talk about some of the science of this? It comes up in paper 72 as a government on a neighboring planet. So they actually give you a lot of the philosophy, and then they actually give you an opportunity to dabble with the science of it all a little bit, the science of government. All right, let's take a moment here.